Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light 3-0 and she's gone!
Welcome to the 3-0 Show. It is Thursday, February 17th. Derek Van Riper, Britt Ciroli, Ido Saris all here with you on this episode. We are focusing on what the players are doing right now, and what the players are doing right now varies a lot on who those players are, where they are located, what means they have at their disposal. So it's a pretty fascinating situation as the owner-imposed lockout rolls on. We should be at spring training this week, right? The report to spring training date would have been the day after the Super Bowl, and here we are, closing in on the end of the first week of what would have been spring training, wondering when spring training will start. So, I begin with a very simple question. Britt, what are the players doing right now? What's the thing they can do to prepare themselves in the absence of spring training?
Oh, I think they're working out. I think they're throwing bullpens. I think guys who don't have jobs are probably a little more on edge, on pins and needles, and we'll get into that later, but you know, right now it's not too delayed, right? So for guys, they may end up throwing an extra bullpen. I think if we get into March, it's like, what are guys doing? Because guys need to face hitters. Guys need to be in simulated games. And then I think they're going to have to get creative, the ones who aren't at a really top-notch facility, for how they kind of stay sharp. Because it's a whole lot different throwing a bullpen in January than it is pitching in a spring game, 3-4 innings at a spring game in March.
Yeah, and I think the most difficult thing is, and you'll notice this if you write about fantasy, is that you like so much of baseball and so much of right now, February and March, is, you know, designed to make it to a certain date. You know, opening day is this thing, and I think that was so difficult about when COVID first hit. We were just like, how long are we going to be doing this? How long is this going to be locked down? When is baseball going to start? And we didn't know if we should take on long projects, or the pitchers didn't know if they should, you know, they should be pitching one inning in their bullpen, doing three inning simulated games. Like, there's that whole progression that you go through as a starting pitcher to get that one inning, and then that three innings, and then that five innings or whatever. And so I think without that starting date, that opening day, I do think that there are probably some issues right now for starting pitchers in particular in terms of how they should be training. I mean, they should have already reported. Was that yesterday? They should have reported, pitchers and catchers, and that, you know, the next week or so would be like the bullpens, and then after that you would pitch in a game. You pitch a whole inning at least, maybe two, and start that progression. So without, I do think it's sort of the next week or two they're going to have to make a decision. Do I pitch like a 1-2 inning simulated game? Is it, you know, will spring training be short? You know, and if spring training should be short, then I should throw like a 1-2 inning simulated game with, even without the guidance of my team. So, you know, there's a couple things that worry me in terms of injuries this year. It's the same thing like with COVID, where, like, you know, this sort of amorphous training without a target date is kind of a little bit dangerous for starting pitchers, I think. But then on top of that, we had that sticky stuff enforcement last year, and there, you know, we had Dr. Mike Sun in a piece I wrote suggesting that if you have sticky stuff, you have a ball attached to your finger, basically, you don't spend any energy actually gripping the ball. All you're doing is, it's attached to you. The ball is attached to you. All you're doing is sort of flinging it. And that if you reduce that and you have to actually spend more energy gripping the ball tighter, then you're going to introduce more fatigue. So, and fatigue is one of those things that doesn't show up necessarily right away. Sometimes it shows up the next season, you know, sometimes it shows up in the off season. And right now, as journalists, it's really kind of tough. we're not getting any information from, you know, some players are out there saying things, but if a player is feeling something right now, doesn't feel good, they're not going to tell you. They're not going to get on Instagram and be like, yeah, my elbow's sore. Like, oh. So we're going to get, it's going to be so crazy when they do sign a deal to get all these health updates, to get, you know, people that maybe had surgeries we didn't even know about, you know, all this sort of stuff that will kind of come through the cracks, and then we'll find out, you know, who decided to throw the 2-inning simulated game and who didn't. I think April will be weird. I think there'll be a lot of injuries again this year, and the training mm-hmm. right now probably reflects a little bit of that.
Is there any downside to going through those progressions on your own, whether you're at a private facility like a Driveline or Tread, or you're working at Cressy's? Like, is there any drawback to being more stretched out if the season gets delayed and just staying stretched out? Because if the season gets delayed, the season's also almost certainly being shortened. We're not going to play deep into November to like make up games on the back end, right? So why not? If you know what you need to do for the purposes of arm care, or even for a position player, just to be physically ready, why not ramp up and then just maintain the level you'd need to be at around opening day once you get there, right? That, Is there some kind of drawback I'm missing with that training-wise that guys are worried about?
Well, you still have spring training. So you ramp up to what? You ramp up to relative to where that spring training will be? Well, if the season's delayed, what are you doing? You're just continuing to throw at that 3-inning mark. You're not really progressing. You're not going to 4-5 because you don't want to be at 5-6 innings when spring training starts, right? So I think it's a good idea in theory, and then you actually think it through and you're like
where should I be? Yeah. And then and the other thing is, like, if you're at a state of the art facility, you're throwing with like a MODIS, like a sensor on your arm, that can sense, you know, direct stress on your elbow. You're throwing to all these TrackMan machines. And like the best setups for the best labs out there, you know, I've gotten the numbers, I've looked at them. We're talking over 100,000. If you really want top of the line, you might be spending $200,000. So, you know, there's very few facilities that are at that level. You might be talking about Wake Forest, Driveline. I don't know if there's five, you know, especially if you take all the team facilities out. So, if you're throwing at a top notch place, then they're going to track you along the way. And if you sort of ramp up and then they're like, whoa, let's cut it off today. You know, they'll see something in the TrackMan. They'll see something in the MODIS. They'll see something and say, let's step off of that. And sometimes that can happen before you even feel pain yourself. Like, there could be something that changes in your pitches, because I think mostly pitchers like feel pain a lot. And so it's hard as a pitcher to know, was that bad pain, or was that just like, you know, it just hurts today, whatever, you know? But, you know, all these sort of tracking things can really help you. But I just saw a picture of Johan Ramirez, and he's an intriguing young reliever. What? Why are you laughing?
I'm just laughing at the randomness of this. Yeah, I just saw a picture of Johan Ramirez. Well, like, was it Twitter?
Yeah.
I assume.
The question was ramping guys up for spring training.
I know, but so Johan Ramirez.
Continue.
I love seeing where Eno goes, because it's never the answer to
the question. Johan Ramirez, like, I think it was actually related to your excellent piece about how difficult it is for minor leaguers in the offseason. So I just saw a picture of Johan Ramirez, and he's throwing off of flat ground. He doesn't have a mound. It's literally dirt, and he's throwing to a tire swing. Working out basically at the local Gold's Gym. Like, that's what's available to him. You know, that's what he's dealing with. And so he's probably a reliever, so it may not be as big a deal. But if there are starters in that same situation, and they seem to me like the most vulnerable, where, you know, they are not even allowed to talk to the team about like where I should be right now, and they're just feeling it out, and they may not have these sort of, you know, state of the art you know, situations wherever they are. So it's not that random.
No, it wasn't. You came back.
It was actually a very good segue. So, you know, segue points awarded here. This does connect to a great story that Britt wrote. It's called "We Are Making Pennies." For many minor leaguers, unpaid off seasons prove more grueling than the actual seasons. We've seen now through your reporting, Britt, we've seen W-2s from players who are in the minor leagues, and you see final numbers under $10,000 for a year, And these facilities, these private facilities that we're talking about, cost hundreds of dollars per month. It doesn't take long to realize that math doesn't work, right? You end up with more players like Yoan Ramirez working in a park with a tire swing, doing the $20 to $50 a month regular gym that people like the three of us go to. Like, you know, if we even have a gym membership, we're going to places like that. That is not equal. That is not the same as being in a situation where you've got motion capture cameras and high grade tech and people helping you get better, which creates these massive disparities between the players that have access to those resources or players just willing to basically throw themselves into deep debt just to take their shot. I find that this is just a really ugly side of the game that people have not thought a lot about until recently.
Yeah, and as much as we tease Dino, it does circle back to his point that when you're talking about guys ramping up, like some guys are going to have the ability to get strapped to these expensive machines and, you know, make sure they ramp up appropriately and don't hurt themselves. And a lot of these guys are throwing to tire swings or throwing to one catcher in a, you know, facility that's not state of the art. And like, what happens to those guys? How do those guys ramp up officially? Who's helping them? Because teams aren't right now. They have no contact with teams. If they hurt themselves, they can't contact a team trainer if they're a covered player. So who's making sure these guys are doing their jobs? Who's making sure these guys are progressing and getting better? And unfortunately, baseball's become a sport where you can't just like throw on your own and get better. You need to go to these places where they can add inches to your off speed and, you know, add to your velocity, because if not, you're behind. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real issue here with the lockout, is that, you know, a lot of these guys who aren't able to do that, who aren't able to afford it, who need to get eyes on them, are not going to get it. And when they do, it's going to be rushed because they're all going to report at once. There's no pitchers for a week ahead of the position players. Right. And so it's just going to be mass chaos for trainers and for the teams to kind of figure out who goes where and who's pitching well and who's dealing with what. And I agree with Eno. I think, you know, I've talked to people in the game. People are really concerned. They had just started to flatline the injuries from the COVID short season. And now that's going to go right back up and peak again because of any kind of shortened season.
But then there's also just like from your piece, like the sort of broken economics of it all, which is, you know, it's some people may roll their eyes at. There's some people who just decided that this is their lot in life. The players have decided they want to play this game. This is how it's supposed to be. They knew it going in. And I mean, I guess that's, you know, I don't know. That seems like a defensible thing to some people, but to me, it's like, you know, like ownership, you know. People are making money off these people, right? People are making money off of these players, even if they're just cogs in a developmental machine. Even if they're not actually going to make the major leagues, the owners make money off of them because they make their other players better. You know, they're like, you know, crash test dummies. You know, it's like Tatis needs someone to play against as he's coming up, right? You know, so like, yeah. they have a value. And it's interesting that you have on one hand this proliferation of data and tech and investment in player development, and so you have people saying, "Hey, we can, you know, take a lot of these players and make them better." If you ask them, they would say, "I would rather have a lot of minor leaguers, because usually player development means I'm going to add a half win. I'm going to add a half grade on the scouting scale. I'm going to make this guy just hit to his 60th percentile." They don't make a Tatis, you know. the Tatis is like junior is like a guy who comes up every 10, 15 years and just explodes. I don't think player development is like, "Ooh, yeah, we did that." You know? Mm-hmm. But you want a lot of lottery tickets, and I'm surprised that the Astros, who are like the player development kings or whatever, they're at the nexus of this, where they had a GM that kind of brought in McKinsey. It was part of this process and the answer was fewer minor league teams, you know, and that was something that you know baseball's ownership suggested in their negotiations with the players union this week. Was to cut more minor league teams. I don't understand. I think even the nerds that do the player development, you'd expect them to say, we want more lottery tickets. We want more players out there that we can improve and get to the major leagues. So I think it's all just basically ownership sees pressure on them to pay the players more. And the way that they see out of it is to have fewer players.
I wonder, this is a question that I think also aligns with some things Britt was writing about. Is the push to have fewer minor leaguers actually a way of cutting costs that you kind of go in a roundabout way where you say, yeah, we're going to have fewer minor league teams because when we draft players out of college or high school in America, we pay them more, but we're going to lean more heavily on international free agents, have complexes in the Dominican Republic that are not part of the minor leagues where we can pay even less money in terms of bonuses.
Oh my God, did you see how many people some of those teams signed this signing period?
Right. It's so true. I don't think they actually want fewer lottery tickets. I think they want cheaper lottery tickets. Instead of spending $20 a ticket, they want to spend $2 a ticket. I think that's what's happening here. It's not we want fewer players in the system. It's that we want to pay the players in the system who already get underpaid severely. We're going to pay them even less because people have caught on to what we're doing here. We can get away with it over here. We can't get away with it anymore here. That's what it feels like is happening here.
In fairness to Manfred, you know, I did think that he said limiting the number of players. You know, as opposed to kind of slashing teams. So I think maybe some of it was like, wow, some teams just signed 60 players out of Latin America this last signing period. Like, that's kind of ridiculous. Like, we need to put a tamp on that. But generally, baseball ownership's plan is to curb spending wherever they can. Put caps on spending. Put caps on international spending. Put caps on bonus spending in the draft. Put caps on the free agent spending. The sort of general idea from ownership is to put caps on spending wherever you can. And so just saying that you can only have 150 players in your minor league system is another cap. But what happens is, and this is really interesting tying in with the economics of what we're talking about, these facilities that we're talking about, and what happens with the missing minor league teams that are gone now, they're indie ball leagues. There's still people playing there, but now it's not MLB's concern anymore. It's the indie balls. They have to do it. Oh, and hey, these teams that are falling behind in player development, it's okay. We'll just send them to Driveline. Well, who's paying for the Driveline? The players. It's like $400 or $500 a month. They got to pay for it. So you're outsourcing your PD to these labs. You're outsourcing your player development to these labs. You're outsourcing even some of your lottery ticketness to these indie leagues. There's a lot of sort of outsourcing where it's like, no, you know, it's like you're outsourcing some player development to colleges even where, you know, it's let someone else pay the money is the idea.
Right. I mean, if one of your biggest costs every year is players, people just get someone else to pay. It's a brilliant business tactic. Is it a good idea for business long term? Is this the best way to develop talent? Is this the smartest way to run an organization? I don't think it is.
Yeah, no, and like I think you both raise interesting points, Derek, with the Latin players, and it's true. They're trying to limit. What I saw was the domestic player list, so that wouldn't even include the foreign players. So you could sign 60
foreign players. The 150 wasn't,
and they wouldn't care. So as Derek said, there's ways around that all of a sudden. And there's a quote in my article from a former minor leaguer named Bryce Hutchinson, and he talked about how, you know, you could sign a high school kid for $100,000, or you could sign 20 Latin players for $2,000 and a plane ticket, and they're overjoyed to come here. To get the opportunity, and there's your cheaper lottery tickets, right? And something that wasn't in my article that, you know, I just simply ran out of room is baseball talks about diversity, right? And we know, you know, we're talking about domestic diversity. We're not talking about Latin players. We're talking about the fact that this is an all-white game now. And they pour all this money into these play balls and these initiatives that essentially are tax write-offs when they could fix the system by paying these players, because right now how it's set up, if you're a minor leaguer, even if you're a top draft pick, you're taking, it's 4 to 5 years as a college kid is about what player development has as a timeline to reach the big leagues, 5 to 6 as a high school kid. So even if you sign for six figures, that's still, you're still stretching your bonus unless you made like $1 million, $2 million, which is really only the top round, maybe the second round. You need parental support. So you need to come from a family where your parents can support you. And I think that's a huge gaping hole in terms of, you know, if you're a young Black player or you come from a disadvantaged area and you're good at basketball and you're good at football and you're good at baseball, why on earth would you pick baseball and try to make it over these years You know, it's not even close. I think that's a huge part of the diversity puzzle. And the answer is staring baseball in its face, but paying these guys a living wage, paying them above minimum wage, which right now they are legally allowed to pay them below the federal minimum wage. That's not a tax write-off, right? That's not a feel good, look at our initiatives. And so that's probably a good part of why they don't do it, right? They'd rather trot out these programs and point to these things they're doing to enhance diversity in the game, when really they are deterring people from getting into this game at the very lowest level.
Right. And that doesn't even scratch the surface of amateur ball, like AAU, and the high costs affiliated with being seen on the showcase circuit. That creates another barrier too. So I think, you know, getting into the game and within the game, there are all these ways that you get pushed out. If you didn't come from the right places, it's an extremely difficult path to forge. And I think people are misguided about it. I think there's more understanding of what it's like to be a professional baseball player in the minor leagues now than there was 10, 20, 30 years ago. I think there's a growing amount of pressure from fans of the game, even saying, this is messed up. Like, there are more people saying that now than there ever have been.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I don't know if we're at a point where it's going to actually change how things are being done, but I'm wondering if through indie ball, if there is a path for things to work better. I don't know what it looks like. I mean, I think when you look at the staggering amount of revenue that comes in from the TV deals, for example, if you said, solve the problem, create a scenario where players who are not in the big leagues get paid more across the board. Okay, well, you'd have some kind of good indie ball league in decent sized cities that draws some kind of legitimate fanfare. But you have to have some kind of massive TV deal to offset the cost of paying everyone at that level, right? There is a high cost to run an indie ball league because you don't have guaranteed money locked in for year over year over year from all the TV deals that are currently in place at the big league level. I think that's a huge barrier to overcome.
Isn't that where baseball's antitrust comes in? They can't have like a AFL or an XFL or any other league that challenges them, right? Isn't that where part of the legislation
right
that baseball has
to sue them? I think, yeah. And
correct. Where the NFL doesn't have, like, the baseball has the strongest government backing of any pro sport. Like, there's no other league.
You'll see that some indie ball leagues are like listed under the umbrella of the MLB. Like, they're still they're still somehow connected, even though it's not, they're not, like, that's why, you know, the Atlantic League was trying out all the different things that baseball wanted them to try out, the mound, moving the mound back and robo umps and all that stuff, because they wanted to have that connection to baseball. And they also knew that they couldn't, because of the antitrust carve out, they couldn't necessarily take them on. And also, I don't know, like, the hardest thing for me is that, you know, going to minor league stadiums, I did go to Vancouver, and that was full, and it was a lively experience, and it was a Friday night. It was a thing to do on Friday night in Vancouver, and people were all over it. But I also have been to like Modesto, San Jose. You know, it's a fairly big town. It's a big city.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's huge. But you know, at San Jose, I would say there was maybe 500 people there. In Modesto, I would say there were 30 people at the park when I was there.
Wow. It sounds like the game I saw in Beloit about 6 or 7 years ago. It was a weeknight, but still, I mean, it was Byron Buxton and Twins prospects were in town playing a bunch of future MLB guys from the A's. I mean, Matt Olson, Matt Chapman were on that team. 50
and
people,
yeah,
100 30, people, maybe.
30, 50, yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know, it only works, as I'm saying, where it's all part of a big player development machine, and they're just playing to play to get better and to improve. it doesn't necessarily work financially, I think, on a local level.
Right.
When you're talking about actually the cost of servicing a stadium and staffing a stadium and how many people actually go to the games.
But these players are like people who own minor league teams aren't paying the players.
Right.
That MLB is. So
that's why it doesn't work so well in the indie ball situation, though, because then you're actually paying the players and you're paying the players, you're paying the staff. You have to have you have to have a stadium.
So it's still profitable at the minor league level, even if there's not a lot of people there, because they're paying nothing for the product. The owners paying nothing, the minor league owners paying nothing for the product. But answer me this, and this was in my story too. The guys who play winter ball plays extremely well, like $10K a month with cars. They get cars, they get food, they get housing. How come winter ball can afford to pay their players, but Major League Baseball can't pay their minor league players?
Is it because they're on TV and they're packed stands? I mean, there's something. There's definitely more energy in a winter ball game than there is at a typical game in Modesto. So
I would like to know more about the economics of that league, because that is pretty fascinating that you can pay at that level that way. I just would have assumed pay was less than half that. It's an area I've never dug into at all, but I found that to be one of the many parts of your story. I was like, whoa, like that sets the bar pretty high. I know even minor league hockey, the AHL, has better pay than equivalent leagues, than AA and AAA in the big leagues. The G League in the NBA pays better. And one, I guess, devil's advocate counterpoint to all this is those teams all have fewer players. The NHL comp is actually more fair than the NBA comp, right? The G League roster is a lot smaller than a typical minor league baseball roster. Okay, so let's just say we're going to shrink the minor leagues. We're going to keep going down this path that the owners have started down in recent years. If you're going to do that, do you not have to at least pay the people you're going to keep the necessary full-time wage they deserve? I mean, it's obvious just in the way that players have to train now that this is clearly a year-round job. This is not 1958 anymore. This is not, I play ball during the summer and then I go work in a factory in the off-season and I go back to spring training, get ready to play ball again in February. We're not
even stop throwing. Yeah, pitchers don't stop throwing.
No,
it's a year-round job, like very clearly. I know there's an exemption because of the Save America's Pastime Act. Think about deceptively named things that have been passed over the years. That's pretty high on the list. There's a lot of contenders there. But I just think about stuff like this and I'm like, okay, fine. You're going to shrink it. You're going to do this. You're going to take baseball away from these places and
then also pay them above a poverty wage. But you know they'll just do both. Shrink it and
they're
going to
do both, because that's the bottom line thinking in play here. And I guess, where else can we go? I thought maybe instead of indie ball, maybe we're talking about more players playing in foreign leagues, right? The KBO and NPB in Japan. KBO has a limit on the number of foreign players that can come in, right? So unless they expand or change their rules, you're probably not going to bring more players in, because that takes away opportunities from Korean players. Like, why would the Korean baseball organization take opportunities away from their own players? Like, that doesn't make sense either. So I just don't see where the game is actually going to grow in a way that for the long, long term is for the actual good here. It just seems like // save money to make more money, and we don't really care what happens down the road.
Right. Well, then this brings up the larger point. Jason Stark had a great column today about what baseball can learn from football. And one of the main points, and I've been screaming this, is all those football games were over by 10 o'clock. The Super Bowl was over. The playoffs were over. All these games were over. Those games start earlier. Now, yes, you make more money starting at 8 o'clock, but at what cost? Who are you losing? Are you losing the young viewership you're trying to grow, that you're trying to gain, right? This is where I think baseball is short-sighted at times.
Yeah, I think that's also true in this, in reducing the minor leagues, because what happens to a player that doesn't make the big leagues is they usually go and become a coach somewhere. They start a travel ball team. They start a facility. You know, that's like if you want to remember some guys in baseball, then just look through the list of like college coaches and local facility owners. It's like, oh, that's what happened to him. And so if you reduce this, you're reducing the footprint you're reducing baseball's footprint. You're reducing it in a physical sense where, like, you're no longer in these towns, but you're also reducing it in terms of the number of people that you're creating as ambassadors that will go out. And also you risk, by not paying them, you risk them leaving with a sour taste in their mouth, right? Where they're just like, that, I don't want to work in baseball anymore. They treated me so badly. You know, they paid me so poorly. I don't want to be an ambassador for baseball. So I don't know, some of the things that sometimes you make a decision, you know, like to get in bed fully with TV and not worry as much about, physical attendance at games. That's a decision that baseball seemingly has made. Right. And if you look at how they're running their business, they care more about the TV deals than they do about attendance. Attendance is down, but, the TV deals are up. And so the choice there is cool in the short term, but again, you're reducing your footprint. You're reducing the number of kids that can make it to that game and then love it. It's very difficult for me to take my kids even to an A's game. It gets really expensive really quickly. And so you're just reducing the chances for them to for younger players, younger kids to start to love this game. Because of the decisions you made, the variable pricing, and all that. And, you know, you've actually had executives come out. You know, there was an Angel executive that came out and said, yeah, we don't want poor people coming to the games. Like, we want richer people to come to the games because they spend more time, they spend more money on merchandise and food. Literally said that out loud.
Yeah. What?
Yeah.
Which Angels executive? I'm going to Google that.
He's no longer there.
I don't think so.
Former that was like Angels executive.
You said the quiet part out loud, dude. You're done.
That was like, wasn't the Cardinals owner at some point, or maybe someone high up in the Cardinals that was like, I love owning a baseball team. I can make $20 million and turn it into a $20 million loss on my taxes legally.
Oh,
right.
Nice.
Remember that quote, too?
Yeah.
That was another great one.
It's an all-timer.
That's how it's made. All right.
I like to always push us in the direction of solutions, and this is one.
Yeah, you
where
are trying. I hear it. You're trying. Thank you for that.
What does the future of this game look like?
I like the idea that you had about going abroad. I wonder if you could lobby for some places to relax some of the rules, because I do know that, like, a friend of mine, her son is a basketball player, and he wasn't sure, like, he wasn't going to go to the NBA, but, like, He actually had a goal of playing in Greece. You know, he just wanted to, or Israel. And there's enough of a basketball leagues in those places where it is a viable thing where you can go there and you see the world and travel and make a little bit of money and play the sport you love. And you know, that's not something that I hear from baseball players. You know, that's something I hear from, like, Dan Straley, who's, you know, could get a minor league deal, or he could get, you know, a couple million more from the KBO. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a guy coming out of college and saying, I'm going to go straight to the KBO because, they're going to give me $30,000, $40,000, and I get to see what Korea is like.
I just think the frustration I have, I know people who reached that level of wealth, the billionaire level, they didn't get there by being these very kind and generous people. Like, that's not how you become that wealthy. I understand wanting to be as profitable as possible from a business perspective. I can at least put myself in the shoes of someone that thinks that way. What I don't understand is why you wouldn't want to grow the game in a way that is sustainable long term. Yes, you're making the game more profitable now and for the next decade or two decades. Why not make the game as big as it can possibly be 3 and 4 and 5 decades from now? Make it a multi-generational machine. Make it an actual global game. Make it possible for countries in Europe to help spread the game to other parts of the world where it's just not as popular. I think compared to basketball especially, there's a ton that baseball could be doing to grow in other markets. And it's just been, you know, a kind of a handful of ideas here, a handful of ideas there, but nothing that's actually made much of an impact from at least what I can tell. It seems like that's been pretty constant throughout the last 20 years or so. Like, where's the next generation of a baseball player going to come from? Probably from the same place as the last generation came from. That seems like a problem compared to the way other sports are growing in different parts of the world.
Yeah. I don't think there is an easy solution other than, like, changing the mindset of those at the very top, right? And
that's not going to happen.
I mean, it's key right now. We're fighting over economic issues. No one next year is going to be like, boy, I'm so glad for the fans. They sorted out those core economic issues. You know, I wrote a column like 2 weeks ago about this. The game, the product itself isn't getting any better. It's almost like baseball is such an old sport that sometimes I think it just relies on the fact that it's always been there and they think it'll always be there. But that's just a dangerous precedent, a dangerous mindset to have, in my opinion. You need to constantly be growing. You need to constantly be changing. The NFL is a great example of that, constantly changing rules. The NHL revamped their rules. I remember when I was little, like all of the icing rules, they changed the blue lines. They made it a more exciting, quicker paced game. And I think baseball, you know, for whatever reason, has always been very resistant to change, especially when it comes to that product. And even right now, as we sit, you know, eventually we'll get a baseball game again. And eventually we'll wonder, why is everyone striking out? Why are there no balls in play? Why are these games 4 hours long? Like, these are issues that are just not getting solved.
Yeah. And it's always the money first. So you got to resolve the money, then you can get back to that and talking about that. And that is contentious in terms of everybody has a different idea of how to solve it, you know? And so you kind of have to go through all the different ideas and try to figure them out. But I don't know. I think that, sometimes I think that maybe relaxing some of the rules about curbing spending for teams might actually be like, it's something that we're like, okay, we're going to kind of relax some of these rules. We're all about curbing spending. Like I said, we're all about curbing spending everywhere. What if we can find places where we can relax it and let the teams kind of do some advocacy for the sport? Because teams would actually set up more development camps. That sounds terrible. More, you know what I'm talking about? The development, the academies.
See, that's the thing.
The ones where they don't pay the players.
Right. The academies get set up in places where it's beneficial to the team, but look what's happening in America. Like, players have to pay for that out of pocket. So I don't know if that's the solution we want either. Like, I think every issue with baseball, you start to solve it and you go, okay, that's not going to work because it doesn't make money. And you solve it the way that would be like for the greater good. Oh, okay, we can't make that happen because of this unintended consequence. Like, it seems like gridlock.
Right, but I'm saying it doesn't have to be just the academies. Let's say that you relax the rules and you say, you know, teams can pay their minor leaguers if they want. Because there is pressure on people to not pay their minor leaguers if they want. You see some teams...
But they can. It's just internal, can right now.
Some teams are kind of doing it. Maybe make it easier for them. Maybe and develop things like have like sort of dorms. That you can help, that there's maybe some internal money, some MLB money that'll help you, or maybe some sort of carve out, like some sort of credit to the CBT tax, where you're like, if you build a dorm like that, that you have, you get some sort of credit somewhere along the way, and then now you're getting now you're incentivizing teams to build dorms, right?
You have to incentivize.
Yeah,
them.
Find Agreed. A way to incentivize it, like. To you know, like, it's okay, Pirates, if you, like, you don't have to spend every dime on the major league thing, if your CBT, if you can, and that is sort of what the process is now, but there's got to be ways to goose that incentive, to actually maybe make some money available from MLB proper, to be like, hey, let's build these dorms, let's have chefs, let's basically give them free food and lodging if we're not going to pay them actual dollars. Now you're getting a little bit closer to, and then you can also say, well, teams, you know, some teams are going to copycat. You know, if all the minor league free agents go to the Blue Jays because the Blue Jays pay more, then some other teams are going to be like, well, we're going to pay more too because we want some of these minor league free agents, you know? And so, you know, if it works, it's going to copycat. But the dorm thing, you know, just finding ways to care for these players, in if it's not going to be straight money in their wallet, find other ways to get money-like things, you know, to them. And you know, maybe that'll save some of the minor league teams, and maybe that'll help save some of these minor league cities, because now they're, you know, there's an actual dorm that somebody has to work there, has to clean it. You know, there's more jobs there. You're actually building real estate. You know, you're locking that team down in Modesto for longer, for example. You know, there's sort of community building aspects of it too. That I think could be beneficial. So I don't know. That's a sort of domestic plan, is to like somehow incentivize teams to kind of solve this internally, but with some goosing from MLB proper.
I just think it's really hard to convey a good idea for how to do things to a group of people that see players purely as assets, when obviously players are people and people should be compensated for their time and their work. But what I cannot ever figure out, every time we have these types of conversations, even if you see players as assets, we know enough about humans to know that they need to eat well and sleep well to perform well. We know that. So if you were a person who didn't even care about the players as people, if you only cared about them as assets, you could make these players more valuable by investing just a little bit of your money into their well-being. Just a little bit. And that doesn't even get through. That's
well, Britt, the part didn't that you have some reporting that the Astros were doing something and they didn't really want to talk about it?
Yeah, so last year I reported the Astros housed all their players.
There you go.
And I kept reaching out to them for comment, and they were like, sorry.
They didn't want to talk about it because it was only an investment. It was just to make their players better.
Yeah, because they didn't want other teams knowing. So, like, yeah, there is that, like, I don't know. If, say, the Mets decide they're going to pay their minor leaguers all an extra $500 a week or whatever, all the other owners are going to get mad at Steve Cohen. So they're not going to do it. Or if they do it, they're going to keep it very quiet, right? So there's that weird internal pressure where, yeah, maybe we should pressure teams to do the better thing, or maybe we should pressure the league to make the rules that say, hey, pay these guys. They're working 6 weeks of spring training, they're at the field for 12 hours a day, they're getting $15 a day in meal money. What are they supposed to be eating for $15 a day? McDonald's. Like, how is that okay? How is that okay to not get your first paycheck until the middle of April? You know, the league has to, in my opinion, We could place the blame all around. The league has to change the rules. The league has to change the rules and say, hey, if you're going to have these guys for a three-week camp, a velo camp or whatever, you got to pay them. You got to give them a stipend. Housing them in meals is great, but you need deodorant. You need toothpaste. What if you have a family, like a cell phone, a car? Like, it's not fair. These guys need to be getting actual dollars for work put in.
Yeah, they're selling spring training tickets, and those spring training tickets are getting more and more expensive. I don't know the economics of Florida so well, but I go to Arizona every year, and there are people in the stands. It's way more than a minor league, you know, situation. And
busy.
those tickets are getting way more expensive. And we're talking about 50, 60, you know, there are $100 tickets to spring training games. And some of them get sold out. You know, the Giants on a Friday night in Scottsdale, they'll get sold out.
Yeah, I went to a White Sox-Dodgers game a few years ago. I think it was like Hyunjin Ryu and Carlos Rodon. It was a good spring pitching matchup. I think I paid $35 out of pocket to sit 40 rows behind home plate.
And none of the players on that field got a dime.
Right. I was here. I was watching a game while I'm here. I'm like, whoa, $35? And now, obviously, you can spend more than that. I think there's another question here that I want to just bring to the table because I've never quite understood this. Why are minor leaguers not allowed, not included as part of the Players Association? Because players go through this. They go through this hell. The ones that make it talk about how terrible it was. Is there something that prevents minor leaguers from the day they become professionals, the day you're drafted or signed? Is there something that prevents them from becoming a part of the union?
I have no idea. I've never understood this either.
I'm sure it's like a legal technicalities. I mean, they're a Major League Players Association.
Yeah, but like, why don't they make it the American Professional Baseball Players Association? Any pro player should be in it, because the reason these workers are so woefully unprotected is because they have no seat at the table. Oh, they're not even included.
I wonder if it's because they don't have the money for the dues. I mean,
also true.
But you could structure it in a way where if you are like years 1 through 5 in the union, your dues are like penny. you can build the rules yourself.
You're getting all the same benefits as the guys that have paid in a ton of money. Here's the other thing. Is the AHL part of the NHL's union? No. The only reason we want this is because MLB has legislation that enables them to not treat these guys like the AHL or the NFL practice squad. Did you guys know the NFL practice squad makes $11,000 a week?
It's pretty good.
And also somebody was like, well, they don't get paid during training camp. I looked it up. They get a $1,000 stipend and then $150 meal money. That's a ton of money compared to $0. So even if you make it to even if you're going to training camp and you have no contract, you're still getting that meal money and that other money.
Maybe there could be like a tiered union situation. I don't know. I think that generally how union works is that everybody has a bit, basically a flat due rate. in order to become a member of the union, and then they theoretically all get the same coverage and the same protection. Mm-hmm. And I think there might be some issues there. But then again, so it's like a chicken for the egg thing, right? It's like, well, if they got paid more, maybe they could afford the dues and then maybe we could have a bigger union. But they're not going to get paid more unless someone's advocating for them, which the union won't do because they're correct. Not members of the union. So it's all kind of screwy.
I don't know, man. I mean, like when I got my first job, I worked at a Jewel Osco in Wisconsin back when they were a grocery store in that state. I was 15 years old pushing carts and bagging groceries, and I was part of a union because everyone was part of it. Like, that's just what it was. And as a 15-year-old, I'm like, hey, look, I'm not here full time. I'm only here like 12 hours a week. This is kind of rough, but it can be done. It can exist. Mm-hmm. It's just a strange, strange thing that it doesn't. And it's, I don't know, it's just a question I've never felt like I've received a satisfactory answer.
And a lot of the stuff that we're talking about too, like it reminds me of Brit and I's story on Wednesday about how, you know, they're like people fall between the cracks. You know, there's a specific example we have of these players right now that are not covered by the union and not cover and are locked out by the owners. You just have these, and I also think of it, the good of the game that you're talking about, Britt. Like, who's thinking about the good of the game? There are these things where, like, if it's not part of the brutal sort of head-to-head between the union and the owners, it's just who's advocating for it, you know, and who's going to push, you know, who is going to push ownership on minor league salaries? Like, who, like, you know. We've got some advocates online. I would argue public pressure is about it. There is no sort of conglomeration of power that advocates for the good of the game on its own, or for the good of minor leaguers. And so they sort of fall between the cracks because all that we have now is the brutal head-on-head collision between the owners and the players, the major league players.
You're right. And there are guys falling between the cracks. I mean, Derek, how would you like to have contributed $90,000 to the Players Union's war chest and then not be eligible to get it?
That'd be cool. I'd be real happy about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's happening. And, you know, and I wrote this story about covered players today and how it only, if you're a guy who was hurt last year, let's say, and you weren't on a 40-man roster, you're not a covered player. And it doesn't matter that you were before. It doesn't matter all the money you paid into the union. You're not eligible for those checks, which I believe someone told me were $5,000 and $10,000. They're like tiered a little bit that guys are getting to tide them over. So you have guys who have paid into the union that are not getting these union checks. And then you have guys stuck.
Yeah, it's not obvious who to blame. Some people want to blame the union. I don't blame the union because the union has rules. It's like, you know, you're in the union, you're not. Like, you know, I think the supposition would be for a lot of these people is that you would get a job and get back into the union. how do you define
union
membership?
Well, you can't get a job right now.
Right, you can't. So that's why they're stuck in the situation. But that's what I'm saying. It's like they're these weird, we have these like sort of structures in baseball. And you know, if it's not within the structure, then people just sort of, they don't care. I mean, even the first response on our article was, I don't care.
But here's the thing. Why can't those players who are currently in limbo get a job? Because the owners locked out the players. Not because the union said you can't get a job. It's because the owners locked the players out. They turned off the faucet. They cut all this off.
I mean, you could blame them, but you know, on their side, you say, well, why don't you have a better definition of who's locked out? Why don't you have a smaller definition? It would just lead to gamesmanship, I think. Like, what if they said, if you're not on the 40-man at the end of the season, that's it. You were just locking out everybody who's on the 40-man at the end of the season. Well, then there'd be free agents right now that could do some sort of like, well, how about this? We negotiate a minor league deal, but if I make the majors, I get $10 million a year.
Yeah.
But again, we've got guys who, what's unfortunate is you've got guys who are looking for just straight minor league deals that can't sign right now.
I mean, that's the rough one.
As you know, and I wrote, like, I get that they can't talk to teams right now and sign deals, but they can't even throw for teams right now, which means when the floodgates open, teams are going to sign their big league rosters. Minor league free agents are like essentially the organizational filler guys. Yeah. So minor league camp starts next week. So these guys looking for minor league deals that can't sign with a minor league team to go to minor league camp, I just think nobody really thought about that and how unfortunate it is. And you're right, you know, maybe if they made the rules a little different, there'd be gamesmanship. But in this day and age, it's just so unfortunate that guys who are trying to impress enough to get a job.
What they need to do, like what Straley said, I need to get in front of the decision makers. Why did I sign early? Because I need to throw in front of the decision makers. I need to show them what I've got. Yeah. And that's basically what Sam McWilliams wants. That's what any of these guys wants, is a chance to throw in front of the decision makers.
Yeah. Sam McWilliams is a fascinating case. He signed the biggest contract ever with the Mets last year for a guy who has no service time. And because he signed a big league contract, even though he has no service time and he's not on a 40-man roster, he is not able to sign a deal. And because he has no service time, he is not a member of the players union, so he's not getting those checks. So it's a very weird thing. He's not part of the union, but he's also not eligible to sign a deal. So really kind of like there's these weird loopholes. And Eno had a great stat, I think, about how many guys have signed minor league deals this year versus like other years.
Yeah, it's,
right?
It's like 40%, 35% of what normally happens. And, you know, in a given year, you have about 400 minor league deals and about 40% of those make the big leagues. So you're talking about 175 players that would play in the big leagues. And you know, not even half of those have signed those deals. So, they're still, and those are significant, like there are significant players every year that signed a minor league deal and, you know, established themselves as major league players. Yeah. I happen to think that Dan Straley is in a position to be one of those again this year. So kudos to him for signing that deal, but he got a carve out because he's coming back from Korea. You know, that's the only reason that he's not, locked out by anybody. So, mm-hmm. Just these weird things that are going on right now. And I think generally I stand by my thought that, like, just if it's not all pro player or all pro ownership, it's falling by the wayside right now.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't fall into one of these warring camps, then you're just sort of watching from the outside being like, well, you know, wake me up when it's over, I guess.
Someone pointed out to me the other day that Cleveland added 10 people to their 40-man roster. So imagine you get added to the 40-man roster, but you're going to double A or triple A, right? You're a prospect. You can't go to minor league camp right now.
Mm-hmm.
But big league camp is locked out. And so you're going to start, what, a month behind all these other guys by the time this gets sorted out in minor league camp? How are you going to be ready for your affiliate?
I'd estimate that probably half of any organization's top 10 prospects that's not expected to hit the major leagues this year, or was not going to go to major league camp this year, is going to be home. Because what you're saying, Gabriel Moreno on the Blue Jays, all these guys, they're on the 40 man. So they're not allowed to show up. So, you know, it's, and if they miss a lot of time, then it's going to be like COVID where you're going to actually, you know, shove a marker into that time and be like, okay, this is where once again we set baseball back, you know.
Yeah.
So I still, you know, I still remain a little bit, I am always the positive one here. I still think what I don't understand is there's a difference between the rhetoric and when you actually look at what they're talking about. Because if you listen to the rhetoric, it sounds like, oh God, we're going to miss lots of months. Like they hate each other and, you know, everything's egregious and crazy and, you know, blah, 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 underwhelmed, blah, blah, blah. You know, all this language that's coming out makes it sound like, yeah, we're going to miss significant time this year. But if you look at what they're talking about a difference of maybe $100,000 on the minimum salary. They're talking about a difference of now, I think, like $60 or $70 million on the bonus pool. They're talking about stuff where they could find a midpoint. In fact, I'm a little disappointed the union didn't ask for a higher minimum salary. You know, I always thought, you know, ask for $1 million. And then Ken Rosenthal wrote a piece asking for $800,000. And then the players union asked for, like, you know, somewhere between $675 and $775. You know, so the players union hasn't asked for that much. I still kind of think that they'll throw a dart, you know, $700,000 minimum salary, $45 million bonus pool. Let's get some gains going.
In a strange way, it still feels like the Players Association tried to play like in this way where it was like, let's just speed this along. Let's get closer to where we're actually going to find the middle ground and not ask for $1 million, hoping to get $750. Let's ask for $775 and try to actually get $775. And I think the owners, just for lack of a better description, are like the biggest jerks in your fantasy league that lowball the crap out of you to start a trade negotiation, even though we know that's not the way to get an actual deal done, right? Like, it's just, it's like the mentalities are still so different between the two sides and how they go at it, that that also leads to the owners ending up with a W in the big picture. Like, it's just how it plays out.
Yeah.
So much fun talking about these particular issues 2 weeks in a row where we go down the rabbit hole. We're like, can we fix baseball? No, probably not. But look, the ways of getting around the long-term future issues of the game, I think it's going to take some creative solutions. They just have to generate more profits for the people up top. Otherwise, they're not going to be considered. So if you have ideas to fix baseball, make sure it satisfies the it has to make money requirement. Otherwise, it's just not going to be heard or considered, not by us, but by the people that would actually, you know, make something like that happen. We need to go. Before we go, I should say you can get The Athletic for $1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/baseball show. Really good deal. We do that from time to time. So this is a great time to sign up. On Twitter, she is at Britt_Giroli. He is at Enoceris. I am at Derek Van Riper. The Athletic Baseball Show returns on Friday.
Thanks for hanging out.